Hey, this is Will Calhoun, the drummer of Living Color. You're listening to The Vinyl Guide. See you soon.
Well, hey, everyone. This week on The Vinyl Guide podcast, well, you heard the man. We have on the show Mr. Will Calhoun of Living Color. Today, we're going to be discussing music, records. We're going to be getting some great stories from his experience. He's got advice and tutelage from the feet of the jazz masters like Art Blakey and Ron Carter, and he's going to share that today. And I got to tell you, Living Color is still one of the best live acts out there. And hey, good news if you're an Australian, you get to see Living Color in December. So you can get your tickets at metropolistouring.com, or you can get all sorts of info, ticket links, and even band merch at livingcolor.com. Oh, and by the way, huge thanks to Gustav and Greg, two of our newest show patrons. These two very handsome fellas signed up at patreon.com/vinylguide and are helping support this show. Now, for show patrons, we have exclusive content, including an HD video of our recent interview with AC/DC and Rose Tattoo bass player Mark Evans, plus all sorts of stuff to come, and it's only for patrons of the show who sign up at patreon.com/vinylguide. By the way, more stuff is coming, so if you like our show, you want to help keep it going, you want to do something nice for your buddy Nate and all the countless hours of interviews and record nerdery I produce, please become a show patron at patreon.com/vinylguide. And with that, let's start our very colorful conversation with Will Calhoun of Living Color. Hey! This week on The Vinyl Guide, we're very excited. We have Mr. Will Calhoun of Living Color dropping by for a quick chat before they get on a plane and head out to Australia for a few shows in the coming weeks. You picked a great time to come to Australia. It's just warming up for summer.
Well, that's fantastic news because it's freezing here.
Are you on the East Coast of the U.S.? Is that what you're escaping?
Yes, I'm a New Yorker. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm escaping the weather, and I'm escaping our political climate, let's say.
Oh, well, let me I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, Will, but you know, we get that out here too. There's a phrase that goes, when America sneezes, the world catches a cold. Unfortunately, yeah, you're not going to be able to escape the Twitter climate here.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
Gotcha.
Anyway, well, let's distract ourselves with a bit of music talk here. Now, I do want to talk about Living Color, the fact you're coming out to Australia. But before then, let's go back a bit. Let's talk records. Now, you grew up on the East Coast. What was the music that was around your house as a young man?
As a young man? Wow. Combination of, I'll just name the artists, Harry Belafonte, Leontine Price, comedy records from Bill Cosby and Moms Mabley, Charlie Parker, John Coltrane. This is my dad's, obviously, his collection. Thelonious Monk, Dizzy Gillespie. Having an older brother and sister, Motown, Jackson 5, Temptations, Smokey Robinson. Then getting a little bit older and getting more progressive into music, and I would say more of the fusion combination of things. You know, there was Fela, there's Bob Marley, there's Mahavishnu Orchestra, different renditions of Miles Davis, Jimi Hendrix. Wow.
Yeah, it sounds incredibly eclectic. Was your family a family of musicians? I mean, they had some great taste.
Well, I have interesting parents that really forced us to study piano and take theory and violin, and my sister had to take ballet, and we had season tickets to the Met and the Nutcracker Suite. Yet when we were older and said we wanted to be musicians, my dad would say, what the hell ever gave you that idea?
A young Will Calhoun, did you have a drum kit in the house? How was that convincing your parents that you wanted to play drums?
Well, I didn't have to. My older brother was a prodigy. He's almost 7 years older. He played amazing drums by age 6. We were two or three other neighbors in my community who had children that were awesome, amazing talents. Raymond Chu lived behind us. His backyard faced our backyard. You can look up Ray Chu and see what he's doing. But basically, by the time he finished high school, he was the musical director for Ashford & Simpson and Diana Ross. And then there's the great Steve Jordan, who when he was 17, he became part of the NBC orchestra and started playing for Saturday Night Live. So these guys were all like my older brother's generation. They came to my house. Our parents all hung out. Some went to the same churches. And I was able to see as a youth, you know, that being on television and making records wasn't impossible because my neighbors were doing it. And I could, and then the hip hop thing came when I was 14, you know, talking about the early 70s. And one of my great drum percussionists, Pumpkin, Errol Pumpkin Bedwood, who was the first person to sell beats to labels in 1972. Yet this guy, you know, can play Rachmaninoff or Beethoven or whatever on the piano. So we had a very intellectually sound and academically strong musical community in the Northeast Bronx. A lot of great guys I didn't mention, but certainly I could walk out of my house and go to in a 4 or 5 block radius, anyone's basement, or go to any basketball game or any park uptown, and I would see killer bands playing Mahavishnu or Miles or Ohio Plays or Van Halen or Aerosmith. You know, these were the kind of things that I was fortunate in the Bronx, mostly in the Bronx, to see in my community. So I didn't have to, I mean, I felt like the drums chose me. I didn't want to be a musician during those years. Somewhere around age 16, I decided I wanted to be a professional musician. But before then, I was just taking it in.
You're absorbing, yeah. Now this is a time period when a lot of these old jazz guys, they're still around. Were you able to see folks like Elvin Jones and the like on the East Coast?
Yes, I was. My last recording is a celebration of Elvin Jones's music. Mm. And yes, I met Elvin. I hung out with Elvin. I hung out with Max Roach. Not like I was their age, but I'll say I met them and they were very informative. Gave me great advice via my teacher, Horace Arnold, at that time. So I was able to meet my drum masters like R. Blakey and Max Roach, Elvin Jones. But yes, I played with Wayne Shorter. I played on his recording and toured with Wayne, High Life, the High Life recording. Mm-hmm. But being around Wayne was also invaluable in that he would tell stories about Coltrane early on, Train, before Train became famous. R. Blakey, playing in the Messengers, composing music, Weather Report, all these things. So Wayne Shorter and I would say Farrah Saunders were two musicians, jazz axemen I worked the most with in my career. I did 5 of Farrah Saunders' tours, and Farrah was an incredible musician, and it was great to hear about the music and the venues and the creativity and the fearlessness at that time. So yes, I was able to meet those kinds of guys, Ornette Coleman. Those kind of gentlemen, yes.
Wow. And if you don't mind, can you share with us some of the wisdom that they passed on to you about drums or music or even just life in general?
Well, a few, man. I mean, Art Blakey told me that you don't play the instrument. You interpret the instrument. And if you're lucky, something will come down and come inside of you and play it on a level beyond your imagination. And he said, those are the nights you have to just enjoy because you're not playing the instrument. The spirit's playing the instrument. And he said, you can drop a stick and you're still going to. So in a roundabout way, Blakey was teaching me about the spirit of music and don't approach the instrument like I'm some academic genius. And if I just put 3 against 5 or if I just use this technique, I'm going to sound amazing every night. There's a very heavy spiritual involvement with the instrument. So Blakey was telling me to be aware of that. And you have to be open to have that experience. You can't be closed-minded about that kind of thing. So there are so many things. B.B. King told me never record or play something that you don't love of your own because you might become famous doing that. And then you have to spend the rest of your career telling a lie.
Yeah.
So... he told me something that stuck with me. Every time I bring my music for someone to hear and they criticize it, I always think about BB because, you know, he told me you don't make music for other people. You make music because that's what you feel at that moment, and you don't have to explain. And Roy Haynes said it to me in a more brutal fashion. But
go on.
You know, Roy wanted me to I mean, basically, Roy, you know, I don't know if we're on the radio now or not, but Roy just said, fuck everything when it comes to playing and making music. You don't do it for other people's approval. not even for me, he said. You make your music, Calhoun, and you play because it is Will. And if I don't like it, that's my problem. Don't make other people's problems your problems. You're being creative. Certainly, somebody can come along and help you or offer you criticism and help you. But if they're going to offer criticism in a way where they're chopping you down, and he said, fuck them. If they're not carrying your cymbal bag or helping you load your drums into the car or paying for your recording session, fuck them.
You know, that goes beyond just music, too. That goes to just about every other profession.
Yeah, I mean, these are great things because, you know, I feel like I've received success fairly young. At least I felt young. I felt green in the business at that time. And I followed these guys since I was 14 or 15. And I went to see them at the Vanguard and the Village Gate and these places. And the two times I went for them for advice is when I wanted to go to Berklee College of Music, in which most of those guys told me don't waste my time. But I still went because I thought it was right for me, but it was good to hear their opinion. And then when Living Color kind of exploded onto the scene, I just, you know, I wanted to, I didn't believe the hype anyway, but I wanted to get advice from, I felt like, genius players, thinkers, and creators that weren't receiving the proper type of accolades, and get an opinion on them on how I should move forward with my instrument as well as with the industry. And everyone was so incredible and gave me such great advice.
Now, I'm not a musician, so there's a lot that I don't know about the creative process when it comes to playing an instrument, especially at the levels that you and your contemporaries are at. But I would imagine when you went to a place like the Berklee College of Music, they'll teach you the chops, they'll teach you the techniques, but then there's this element, just like you said, Art Blakey said, the spirit. There's there's the head and then the heart. And then there's a transition that correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a point in time where you transition from the techniques to actually having that spirit kind of flowing through you. How do you manage that transition? How does that changeover happen?
Well, the short answer is you have to be open to it. I still study often in West Africa drummers because I'm trying to learn about my instrument from 40,000 years ago and what the beats meant and how the vibrations of those rhythms created what they said, rain, happy family reunions and wonderful harvests and safe childbirths and for weddings and funerals. I'm still studying. It's been an 18-year run for me, and I go back. I'm still learning these things. So you have to be open. I mean, it begins with being open. The academics are always going to be there. As Muhammad Ali said, and it was shocking to read this quote from him, the hardest thing about his career was training. You would never believe that if you look at Muhammad Ali, especially in his prime. He's always on the speed bag and on the ropes, and but he hated training. He hated it. But he said boxing is 90% mental and 10% physical. Because he knew how to beat his opponent before he got in the ring. That's called being open. And I feel like you can learn all the chops in the world. I can learn all the stickings, all the rudiments, all the crossovers. My technique can be really high. If you're playing bass and I'm not listening to you, I'm not feeling what you're playing, then we're not going to make music. So the open part about it is there. And you'll know if you're open when to put the salt, which might be the academics, and the pepper, which might be the spirit. You'll know exactly how much to put into each meal, into each performance, into each song by being open. It's nice to have the academics. You need the technique, absolutely, especially playing classical music. But how do I make that transition for me? It's by being open and not having any walls, not thinking about. I don't talk about it with a lot of musicians. You're asking me this question. And it's personal. I don't mean it's personal in a way that I don't want to share with you, but I don't talk about my musical beliefs with people because I don't believe in styles of music, actually. I think styles of music are a terrible way to interpret music, but a fantastic way to sell it. You know? So I stay open. I like drum and bass. I like electronica. I like disco. I like hip hop. And when I'm playing, somebody hands me a piece of music or wants me to play something, the first thing I want to do is interpret it as best as possible. But believe me, I'm borrowing from many camps that some of those leaders, if I told them that, they would fire me. But the most important thing is that they like what I'm doing. As long as they like what I'm doing or they love it, that's enough. I don't have to tell a jazz guy who hates hip hop that this interpretation comes from a Public Enemy record or, Run DMC record or vice versa. Sometimes terminology scares people. Jazz is a word that can scare people. What do? I play jazz. People automatically think that's MIT music, and that's really heady. Chord changes and solos are boring or for old people. So you have to be careful with the titles. Just like you can say, I'm Irish. What does that really mean, that you're Irish, that you're from Ireland? You could be born in Australia and your parents are from Ireland. What does it really mean when someone says that? You don't have all the facts. Somebody says, I'm Irish or I'm Italian or, I'm Indian. Whatever. What does that really, really mean when you say it in a sentence? It has no meaning to me. It's just an identified area that you have to get specifics on. And with music, I think when you start to do that, you alienate people, you alienate that spirit, and you alienate the academics, and you alienate a great opportunity to be creative. So I avoid it, but I just don't tell people that I avoid it. Somebody says, please swing, I need a bebop. Will, I want you to play short time. I want you to play halftime here. I need a short stop. I need a blues intro. I learned all those things, so I know the codes. But when I'm creating, I'm borrowing from every code possible.
The connection between the drums and the bass player seems to be a tighter connection than most, very unique. How could you tell if you have a connection with a bass player? For instance, I'm assuming there's obviously one there with Doug and Living Color, but say Ron Carter, you work with Ron Carter, an inarguable genius. But the first time you step in a room with a guy like Ron Carter, how do you know if there's going to be that connection?
I can tell you my first time I stepped into the room with him, I was playing a jingle, a TV commercial, and I was so excited I'm going to answer a question, but I just want to tell you this quick story.
Yeah.
I was so excited to meet Ron, and I was like, wow, my face was all elated, and I have all the records, and I'm a Miles 60 band junkie, and I'm doing this commercial for Jeep Eagle, and it's an uneven amount of bars. It's 6 bars of very fast swing. But the producer wanted us to play a couple of bars up front and then cut us in so it would sound like we were playing already. Ron wanted to play and stop, play and stop, because he's a genius at it. And the rest of the guys in the ensemble couldn't do it on the level of Ron. So anyway, we nailed it in like 3 takes. Most jingles are done in 1 take. So I jump off my drum set to run outside of the drum booth to go speak to Ron. And he's already got the bass zipped up. He already has his coat on. He's already at the elevator pushing the button to go downstairs. And I went outside and I ran to the elevator and I said, "Oh, Mr. Carter, excuse me. My name is Will Calhoun. I just really wanted to meet you and say hello." And I didn't know what to say. And he's a tall guy and he's kind of intimidating a little bit. And he looked at me and said, "Well, now you met me." And he got in the elevator. So, I don't know if I made a connection, but when I finally got to see him years later, and we're great friends now, I reminded him of that. And I asked him what he thought. And he said, well, if I didn't like what you were doing, you would have known. That's what he told me.
Silent means consent.
Yeah. I mean, how do you make a connection there is, if you're enjoying the music and he's enjoying the music, yes, Ron, at that time, I was 21 or something. It was very intimidating. When he played with me on my recordings, people were telling me, watch out, man. He doesn't do overdubs. Don't ask him to play something again. Let him play. Make sure the music is right. And so I was panicking. I'll talk to him maybe 10 times on the phone before that. But I said, Ron, can I send you a car? He said, nope. Would you like a per diem for the day? Nope. You going to bring your bass? Can I have a Carter to play your carding service? Nope. Everything was nope, nope, nope. He showed up. He played great. He asked me that I like what he put down. And he said, are you sure you're okay? Have another listen. And he left. So how do you know? I just think you can feel it in a bass player. But our jobs are different than any other job on stage. And I think if you... not to sound too political, if you separate the drummer from the bass player, it's even more. I mean, drummers get along so well than any other instrumentalist. If you have a drum convention, it's going to be 1,000 guys hugging and saying hello and having a beer and whatever. You can't do that at a guitar convention. No one's going to talk to you. No one's going to show up. And the instrument has another kind of a culture to it, I think. It's very competitive. It's like lead singers. It's kind of like a fashion show with who's the best model almost. You know, our job is to make everybody sound tremendously well. It's a very unselfish, thankless job in the back of the stage. They put you in the back of the stage, which is already the first crime. Then they want you to, people walk by and they whisper, hey, man, you know, when I'm playing, I need you to lay off the hi-hat. Okay. Hey, man, on my solo, I need you to step on it. Okay. Hey, man, on my solo, never rush. I need you to stay where you are. Or I have a blues guys. I'm going to play behind the beat, Will. Don't join me. I know where I am. You stay where you are. So you have to make every, you know, I call it the single mom, where you got three kids in the background and you're making food and you're on the phone and you're checking homework at the same time, making everybody happy. That's kind of what our job is on the instrument. And the guys that are brilliant at it, we know how to manipulate music. We have to, because we're working with four plus or more personalities on stage at one time in the same piece of music. So I think our brains work a little bit more, and it's a lot more academics going on in our head if you're paying attention, because you are driving the bus as a drummer. You are the leader. And if you stop playing, I've tried it. You just pull the carpet out, or you remind one of those guys, and sometimes you have to in a song, they'll turn around and look at you like you know, they owe you money. So, you know, the idea is for you to, without an ego, control that scenario where it works for the band and for the audience. Your closest and best mate in that situation is the bass player, period. That's it. Anybody after that is a second or third cousin. Your next closest mate is the bass player. And if you guys both understand that role, it's even an easier job for you to do, and you'll have more fun doing it.
I think you used the key word there. I think ego. Like, you have to manage that, and not to oversimplify it or overgeneralize, but, you know, you guys got to hold back. It's almost like improv. In doing comedy improv, the most important person is everyone else but you.
It's a very good point. Yeah. It's a very good point. People don't understand. I mean, I'm working on a literary piece now on drumming and life, because I think in life, my life has been similar to my role on my instrument. I don't know about other drummers, but in my family, I've had to play that role. In Live in Color, I play that role, you know, and there's other things that where, you know, you have to manage things in a certain kind of a way. I just think as drummers, we innately come with this talent because the instrument lends itself to you supporting other people. Even if you're a Billy Cobham or a Terry Bozzi or one of these guys that plays out front, you still have to be the support system of a rhythm section. You have to be it. There's no doubt about it. And it's an important role, but it's not an easy one. And the brilliant guys, you know, the Steve Gadds and the Steve Jordans and the Vinnie Colaiutas and these guys that know how to make other people's music sound spectacular while leading. Now, us drummers, we know what's going on. The audience may not, but we know. It takes a real special balance of ego, talent, professionalism, and you got to throw in a little bit of quirkiness in there at times, just to, you know, put a little hot sauce on the sandwich.
So, talking a little bit about Living Color, you guys came back last year with an LP, Shade, the first Living Color LP in about a decade. Why the wait in between albums?
Man, I wish I could give you an answer that that I knew that was. I mean, there's no reason to wait 10 years, but art comes when it comes. The band went through quite a few changes during those 10 years of managers, attempts to restart the engine, how are we going to do it? It was kind of like a NASA thing where, you know, we just couldn't get the rocket, the right information and timing and the day and the weather and the trajectory, right? We couldn't get all of those things right. It just was like three things were right and two weren't. And finally, it fell in place. And that's another lesson you learn about art. You know, art's bigger than you. You don't really control it. It's like I look at it. Love is kind of the same way, not to get too far off on a tangent. You don't really, you feel it and it feels amazing, but the worst thing you can do is try to control it. You'll realize that you're you are...
you might as well try to control the wind.
Exactly. You are out of control, two of your cats or whatever. Take your pick. I mean, it is kind of really what it is. So Shade happened when it was supposed to happen. I love the recording. I did wish it came out 3 or 4 or 5 years earlier, but it wouldn't have been Shade. Mm-hmm. So we had to go through those some beautiful, some horrifying steps to get to that point where Shade was developed. But, you know, it's an interesting, it's a great question. It's an interesting process because Vivid was quick. Time's Up was even quicker and Staying was also quick. But the different time, different vibe, you know, songs are already written. Things are already, you already had a producer chosen. The studio was already booked. There was different, you know, Shade was really a process that started out as what are we going to do and led to Shade versus Time's Up and Staying where we had songs in the kitty already and we were playing stuff live already. We were auditioning songs in front of audiences. And with Shade, we didn't have that luxury. We had to really go in and create a new scenario for ourselves. So I don't know the full answer on why, but I just know that that particular recording and those songs were not ready until the time Shade came out.
So do you think it's going to be another 8 years before the next album?
No, I think it's going to be another year or two before the next album. Relationships exist upon the past and the future and a little bit with the present. But I think our past of before Shade led us to going through that 8-year process. We couldn't make a record in a year or two. It just wasn't possible, to be honest with you. It wasn't laziness. It was impossible. Now we're going further ahead, and we had that 8-year gap and put a record out. That past is going to help us to make something, I think, better and quicker for the next recording. That's just my opinion. Somebody else in the band might tell you something else. But, you know, that's art is... it touches you. You can't really touch art. Art touches you. You create it and it touches you. You create it and it changes you. You can't really go in and not really and change. It has the effect. You're the person that's affected by it because it's done now. It's created. You listen to Stain and listen to Shade and that's it. No one in the band is happy. It took 8 years. I have to say that honestly. We were not planning on an 8-year gap, but that's what happened. And it was a tough time. It was tough. We were getting frustrated. We were going to throw in the towel a few times. We felt like, you know what, maybe this is not a record we should do now. Let's chuck the whole thing and start over again. Mm-hmm. There were different things, but I'm glad everyone stuck it out. And Andre Betts, the producer, stuck it out. And I think we made a really brilliant recording under the circumstances and time and freedom and creativity aspects we were in during that time.
All right. Well, we certainly hope the next one doesn't take so long, and we're so glad that you guys are coming over here to Australia. Just to remind everyone, Will and Living Colour are playing Australia the end of December, just before the holidays, starting west and going east from Perth, Adelaide, Melbourne, Brisbane, Byron Bay, and Sydney. You can get your tickets at metropolistouring.com, or there's links on livingcolour.com. Will, thank you so much, and we hope you really enjoy all Down Under has to offer.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, that was a fun one. Thanks, Will, for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. Again, I want to remind folks they can check out Living Colour's tour dates at livingcolour.com. There's a bunch of Australia dates that are happening in December, and then they're playing Las Vegas on New Year's Eve, I think, and of course, 2019, they'll have a whole bunch of shows all over the world, I'm sure. So go to livingcolour.com, or if you're in Australia, you could always go to metropolistouring.com and get tickets for these shows that are in December. They're going to be awesome. And one last thing, if you are a fan of Living Colour, check out our Vinyl Guide interview with Vernon Reed, episode number 84, where I caught Vernon directly off an international flight. And hey, we had a conversation. Quite interesting. Episode number 84 of the Vinyl Guide podcast, available at thevinylguide.com. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Make sure to visit our sponsor, Groove Washer, at groovewasher.com. We've got a 10% off promo code, VinylGuide10. We'll get you 10% off anything. So load up your basket full of cool, neato record accessories and cleaners. Get to the checkout and type in promo code
Vinyl Guide 10. You'll get 10% off your entire order. That's at groovewasher.com. And we'll be back next week with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.